many climate people, I'm convinced, would have been religious zealots in the past, and now they're climate zealots.
My guest today is Latimer Alder.
I'm what you call, might call an independent commentator on matters climate and matters other things as well. And what does that mean? That means I'm in the olden days, I would have been considered a gentleman of independent means, which is lovely. It means I don't have to work. I don't have to worry about paychecks or bosses or commissions or doing what other people tell me, because I've never been very good at doing any of those things. I'm not a member of any learned societies. It's great not being a member of any learned societies. You can't be kicked out of a learned society you're not a member of. So that's fantastic. Over the years, some of you may know if you've ever followed me on Twitter, I'm a fan of Aldershot Town Football Club. And boy, if you're a fan of the Shots, you really have to have a thick skin and broad shoulders, because we've had some dire times recently. Happily, things are a little bit better this season. And this means I can say what I mean and mean what I say on Twitter. I'm going to talk about climate data for dummies, and I've given it this title in tribute to the great yellow books you see all around the bookshops. Used to be just about IT type things, but now about other things as well. And what they're great at is that they try to take complicated technical subjects written by specialists, but make them accessible to everybody. Way back when I was a kid, there was, you know, DIY books. They're the same idea. Same color, funny enough, yellow. And what I hope to do today is to show you that you don't need a brain the size of a planet to be able to understand this. You don't need to be a great scientific intellect. You don't need to have studied for many years. You don't need to write climate models. You just need to be able to look at some data. And nothing we're going to do today is anything more difficult than looking at data and doing a little bit of arithmetic, nothing more complicated than divide, and getting a perspective on climate data, because that's the thing that's always lacking. We see an awful lot of stuff about climate data, which just is gee whiz, but hardly any that is gee whiz in perspective. So let me try and move on and just tell you a little bit how I got to where I am today from the sort of intellectual point of view, not just from the what I do now. Well, I started as a chemist. I studied chemistry to master's level. I mean, the top left here, you can see a chemistry lab, and that's a reminder that chemistry is a practical science. You don't do chemistry by sitting around and thinking about it. You don't do chemistry by going to conferences. You don't do chemistry by having colloquia and all coming out with agreements and consensuses. You do chemistry in the lab, on the bench, by finding out, by doing it, what Mother Nature does. And that's a great lesson. It's what I call the most show me science. And show me is the thing that goes all through this presentation. When I finished with chemistry, I went on to work in what we now call IT, but in those days we started off calling it data processing. And I worked in the commercial field, big data centers, big complicated problems. And what we were really doing was setting in the foundations for today's internet and the sort of stuff we can do over the internet. The fact that you can be in China and buy something from somebody in Finland over eBay and pay for it, if you want to know, Argentinian pesos, isn't magic. The fact it can happen is a lot of hard work by a lot of clever people over a lot of period of time. And I had a great time. I thoroughly enjoyed my time in IT, and I met some very interesting and very talented people. But again, the thing that matters there is that people don't pay you for systems that might work or they think might work, or possibly, well, you thought it might have been a good idea, but it didn't actually work, but it was very interesting to do so. They sign the check because they have a system that does work. And we're back to the idea of doing as well, doing as in chemistry and doing in IT. And the chart down here just shows I did not just the application side, but sort of a lot of the big businessy management, project management that goes with any big systems that you're trying to do. And I did that all for 30 years. And then I took a bit of a change, quite a considerable change, another 5 years when I went to work on London buses. And there used to be a phrase the lawyers used when I wanted to talk about an ordinary person. In the UK, they would come up with the idea of the man on the Clapham omnibus. And that was their idea of what an ordinary person was. Clapham is a suburb of South London. Funny enough, my father lived there when he first moved to London before the Second World War. And here's a picture of a red London bus, the icon of London. It's at stop E2 in Eden Street in Kingston upon Thames, and it's a number 57 bus. And if you look very closely here, you see it was going to Clapham Park. Well, this was one of my routes. This was one of my buses. So I was indeed that man on the Clapham omnibus that is supposedly the ordinary person. So with chemistry, with IT, and with the man, being the man on the Clapham omnibus, reckon I'm qualified a little bit to talk about things that ordinary people are interested in, not academics, not specialists, not PhDs and DPhils and all that stuff, but just ordinary people. Right, let's now talk about somebody who definitely wasn't an ordinary person. This man really did have a brain the size of a planet. His name was Richard Feynman. And by his own account, he was a great bongo drummer. He worked on the atom bomb project in the United States in the war, and he became known as the safecracker. If you had confidential documents in your office and you came to work on a Monday morning and you thought these confidential documents were perfectly safe and nobody could get at them, you might open your safe and find there's a little note in there saying, "Very interesting. Best wishes, Richard Feynman," because he would have managed to break into all the safes in Los Alamos. He was a great science communicator. When the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up and the seven astronauts were killed, they had a huge, great commission that took months worth of evidence and stuff trying to find out the causes of this. And Richard Feynman was on that commission. And when it came to the sort of final day, he showed people with no more than a coffee cup, some ice, and a little bit of material from the space shuttle. He showed in 10 seconds exactly what had gone on and told us why. And at that point, there was no further debate. Feynman had nailed it. So that was a pretty good set of achievements. Oh, and did I forget to mention? Oh, he won the Nobel Prize for Physics as well. So he was what we would call in the UK quite a geezer. Anyway, the point of Feynman here, apart from he was a remarkable man, was once upon a time he was asked, "Richard, what is science all about? When you're doing science, what are you really doing?" And he had a voice. Imagine this is Kermit the Frog saying this. He sounds exactly like Kermit the Frog. He says, "Well, what we're doing in science is we are making guesses, or you might call them hypotheses or models or any of these things. We're making guesses about what Mother Nature does. And we make these guesses, and that's not science. What is science is the bit where we go and test that with experiments. And we either collect some data or we make some observations or we do an experiment like I was showing you in the chemistry." And he says, "If it disagrees with experiment, it is wrong. In that simple statement is the key to science. It doesn't make a difference how beautiful your guess is. It doesn't make a difference how smart you are, or who made the guess, or what his name is. If it disagrees with experiment, it is wrong. And that's all there is to it." Now, he's absolutely right. And all true science works on that thing. It is what the data says, what the experiment says that matters, not what the scientists say. A scientist saying something is actually a human telling you something. It's the science is about the data. And that will be my theme going through this as we continue. So how did I come to do all the stuff I've been doing on Twitter, if you've ever seen some of the stuff I did on COVID? Well, this was how it all started. It used to be in the UK that 5 o'clock on a Saturday evening was football results time. And we'd all dash away from the match and looking through the TV shop window at 5 o'clock as we're going back to the station after the game to see what the football results were. And they'd all be put up on BBC and intoned by a man called James Alexander Gordon. Well, when COVID came to the UK, our then Prime Minister, this guy in the middle, Boris Johnson, you may have heard of, kind of stole 5 o'clock and made it, during the week, he made 5 o'clock became, instead of football results, it was COVID results. And every evening with his two trusty lieutenants, he would appear from Downing Street, the home of the Prime Minister, and in depths of great gloom, exactly how many people had died with COVID or from COVID or within 28 days of COVID, or had an auntie who once thought they might have had a sniffle and it might have been good, whatever it was, every day. And this became a national event. My girlfriend would make sure that she was just settling into her first gin and tonic at 5 to 5 every evening, so she never missed a trick of this doom fest that Johnson was going on. Anyway, as this went on and on, clearly the number of people in the country who had died continued to rise. The cumulative total went up. And it came to a point where, at one point, I had the total reached 42,000. 42,000 people in the UK had died with COVID. One of my friends, a very numerate lady, teaches finance for a living, was very despondent. She thought 42,000 people was a huge amount of people and, you know, we're all going to die and what was the point? And I'd looked at it a different way because I'd been looking at it from the, what proportion of people is this? And actually 42,000 people in the UK is about one person in every 1,600. So I wasn't too bothered. We'd been promised the Black Death. And the Black Death was, by all accounts, killed about one person in three. And here was COVID, the quotes, new Black Death. Well, it was killing one person in 1,600. Hey, I'm not too bothered. But she was, and it took her to get her calculator out to do the sum to persuade herself that 42,000 was one in every 1,600. And that was a moment where I thought, hang on. Even if people see these numbers, they don't put them into perspective. Even numerate people can't put these into perspective. And I started to think, what could I do on Twitter to bring this to mind? Because I've been using Twitter over other stuff anyway. And Twitter's very different from journalism, and it's very different from academia, and it's almost very different from TV. And Twitter is absolutely instant. You have 1 second to make your point. If you don't make your point in 1 second, people will move on to the next one, celebrity, MasterChef, or whatever it might, or politics, or whatever, football, whatever. It doesn't matter. You have that 1 second to get it. And so it's got to be graphic. What I thought I realized was it had to be graphical because we are a visual species, and everybody can understand charts to an extent. Even if they can't read and write, they can probably understand a picture. And the conventional way of showing proportions graphically is to use a thing called a pie chart. Well, a pie chart wouldn't work because pie charts don't work for anything less than about one part in 100. So eventually I came up with this idea. And this idea is the squares. And if you look at the squares, very simple and it's very easy to understand. You got a big square here. And in this particular case, this is really the end of COVID chart. This is the end of, you know, UK. If you ever want one chart, COVID in the UK over 3 years, this is it. Big green square around the outside represents the total number of people. So this is effectively the 68 million people in the UK. Little yellow square at the top left represents the total number of people who died in the period. So that's March to March, 3 years. Up to March this year. Total number of people who died is the yellow square. And the red is the people who died of COVID or with COVID or whichever definition you're going to use. And so you can see that overall, nearly everybody lived. One in 38, I think it is, died of something in that time. But only one in 325 died with COVID in 3 years. Wow, this is not kind of what we were led to believe when we're thinking about the Black Death that's going to kill one in three. It's not even 1/100 of that. And you might look at that chart and anybody can understand it. You might say, well, maybe this COVID stuff wasn't quite the big serious problem that everybody made out it was going to be. And even while it was going on was made out it was. Interesting. Now we get to something a little more climatey, and this is carbon dioxide. I was accosted at a party by an acolyte of Greta Thunberg. And this was a young girl. She was about 15, very Greta-like in many ways. And she heard that I was interested in climate things. And she came charging over to me And the burden of her song really was that carbon dioxide was already over half the atmosphere. She was going to either suffocate from carbon dioxide poisoning or die in a heat wave before she was 35. It was all my fault. What was I going to do about it? Well, it's a bit of a difficult task to do anything. I've tried to calm her down and give her some realism, but she was a teenage girl, and teenage boys do exactly the same. So she was stuck on these big ideas that she got into her head, and I'm sure I did the same as well when I was that age. And wouldn't be moved. She knew it was true, and don't worry with the fact she's got a water fight sort of thing. And I discovered that, and I thought, these square graphs I've done for COVID also work for carbon dioxide. This is the one that shows exactly how much carbon dioxide there really is in the atmosphere. Again, it's a green square and a red square, not too difficult to understand. This one is 50 by 50. 50 units by 50 units down here, and the red square is one. So it's really one part in every 2,500 of the atmosphere is made up of carbon dioxide. And that's all. Not any more than that. A lot of people, when they see this chart, go absolutely bonkers. It's like heresy that anybody should show carbon dioxide as being of these proportions. You're not saying anything about its properties here, just showing how big it is. But they don't like that. They really can get very, very, very upset. And again, it's a bit like religious. I'm told there are religions where showing pictures of their god or prophet or whatever it might be is severely frowned on. Well, this often is the same thing here. But that's all it is. When people tell you about carbon dioxide, it's about one part in 2,500. But they say it's been changing, and they're absolutely right. It has been changing. And we can look at how much it's changed, and we've got pretty good measurements of carbon dioxide, and they measure it very, it sounds like a very nice place halfway up a volcano in Hawaii, a place called Mauna Loa, and they've been measuring it pretty accurately for 60 years, and you can see that in the 60 years, it's gone up from 320 parts per million up to 420 parts per million. But no, but remember these, when you see these numbers, sounds terrifying, 320 to 400. It's parts per million. Yeah. It's one part in 2,500 up here, and it was about one part in 3,300 down here. It's still not a dominant gas. It's a very, very small amount of gas involved. Let's move on through to the next one. Let's look at temperature. This is the standard frighten the life out of you temperature chart that you'll see from almost any presentation about global warming. And I've chosen to use the data here from the Hadcrut 5 data set. There's about four worldwide data sets. And they all say, well, we can measure the change in the absolute temperature of the world pretty accurately. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But let's assume for the moment they can. And these are the changes that they've seen. And it's a good graph because here's the thing. It goes straight up to the top right-hand corner, fills the graph. Oh, my God, what's going to happen when it gets up here? And it's, like I say, it's the frighten you stupid graph that you see almost everywhere for anything. But let's look a little more closely. Down here, we see it's a thing called a temperature anomaly. And this is saying this is not a temperature. It's anomaly really means change. So this is the change in temperature that we've seen over these years, 1960 to 2020. And if you look at this, which we call the y-axis, the vertical axis, you can see that the actual amounts of temperature change here are very small. This is from here to here is 1 degree centigrade. Well, if you think about 1 degree centigrade, 1 degree centigrade, if I plug that into the central heating air conditioning in my house, well, do I notice it? Yes. Do I notice it if it does it in a couple of hours? Yeah, I might sort of think it's getting a bit warmer or a bit cooler. If the same change happened over 60 years, would I really notice it very much? I think the answer is probably not. And that's the size of the global warming. When people say we're headed for boiling Earth or hot house Earth or horrific 3 degrees or something, whatever the latest hype is. Well, just think about it in terms of your personal air conditioning wasn't reading. It's not a very big number. So I took a little idea to myself, and this, take a few moments on this chart. The previous chart showed the change in temperature. Well, that's great. And, you know, that's a bit like saying, how tall are you today? Well, I'm an inch taller than I was 10 years ago. Okay, that's fine. But it still doesn't answer the question, how tall are you? You actually need to know that an inch, you know, 10 years ago I was 5'9", therefore today I'm 5'10", or whatever it might be. Metric, I don't care about the units, but it's just the ones I use. So I did a bit of research, and everybody seemed to be of the opinion that the absolute temperature was about 14 degrees centigrade. Fair enough. Not far off the average temperature in London, which is 11 degrees centigrade. So let's call that the base of our graph. And then rather than just saying, well, I'm just going to make my chart fill the data, because that will make a very narrow chart, I thought, what would be good numbers to put in at the top and bottom here? I thought, well, what about temperatures that real people actually live in? And we can find that out quite easily. There's a wonderful data set on Wikipedia, and it's called Cities by Average Temperature. And you can look through this stuff, and it's got hundreds of different cities in the average temperature, which could be very interesting to look at how places compare. Anyway, the hottest city in the world on average over a year is Khartoum in Sudan, and its average temperature is 30 degrees. That's its average. So you can imagine it gets pretty hot in summer. It probably don't get very cold in the winter. And the coldest place at minus 10 is Irkutsk in Siberia. You might guess it was going to be in Siberia. And that's a very long, very long, very cold day. So even the average is minus 10 degrees. And you can see that the range of temperatures that humans actually live in today is 40 degrees, from minus 10 to plus 30. When you plot the whole thing, the change of 1 degree centigrade that we saw from all the big data sets here, you say, well, actually, this is not a big change. We know they can live anywhere between minus 10 and plus 30. And somebody could get on an airplane in Irkutsk and be within 36 hours in Khartoum and survive. They could survive a 40 degree temperature change in 36 hours. So they sure as heck can survive a 1 degree centigrade change in 60 years. Last thing on this chart is, now we know it's 1 degree centigrade in 60 years. It doesn't take too difficult to work out how much it is per day. And it's 1/20,000th of a degree per day. And again, when people frighten you with global warming at an unprecedented rate, that's all it is. It's 1/20,000th of a degree per day. A bit like saying, blimey, there's a fast snail going up that wall. To which the answer is, yeah, but it's still a snail. So bear that one in mind as well. Now, go back to do a little bit of chemistry. This is probably biochemistry, but we'll call it chemistry because I'm a chemist by trade. You probably learned this stuff at school, or if you didn't, you should have. And this is all about photosynthesis, which is a complicated Greek word, and it just means making things with light. And there's a diagram of how photosynthesis, which means how plants grow, why plants grow. And this really is the basis of all life on Earth, with almost no exceptions. This bit of clever chemistry that Mother Nature does is what gives everything on Earth its energy. Let's start at the top. Up here we have the sun. And the sun is the only source of any energy for the world. So eventually everything comes back to the sun. In the air we have carbon dioxide, CO2, the stuff that we saw. It's one part in every 2,500. And either in the air or in the water or in the soil, but from somewhere, we also have water, H2O, dihydrogen monoxide, if you want to call it that. And photosynthesis is a marvelous thing. It takes light and carbon dioxide and water, and it makes plants from it. You don't need to look at the detail of how it does it, but that's what happens. Those plants grow, and then they either get eaten by other animals, in which case we eat the animals or we eat the plants. It doesn't matter. But the energy that's captured from the light eventually comes back to us as our energy that we eat, or eventually, if this is all stored underground in oil or coal or gas, it comes back to us as fossil fuels that we use to gain our own power. What we can sort of think about is, well, if we know we need all three of these things, you know, if you try gardening in the dark, it doesn't work. If you try gardening without water, it doesn't work. If you try growing stuff without any carbon dioxide, that won't work either. But we might think, if we increase the amount of carbon dioxide, do the plants grow better? And if you've been doing any gardening at all, you probably know that plants grow better in the summer than the winter. Part of that is because it's warmer. And if you were doing Richard Feynman's idea of saying, well, we'll make a guess about what we think Mother Nature does, and then we'll go and test it, we might guess that a warmer world from climate change and a warm world with more carbon dioxide, as we've seen before, we might guess that this ought to be a world with more plants. So now all we got to do is go and test this idea. And isn't it wonderful? Our friends at NASA have done this for us. What they do is they have a set of satellites rotating, photographing the globe all the time, round and round and round and round and round. They've been doing it for the best part of 40 years. And their satellites are looking just at how green the world is. You could imagine you put a green filter on through the lens of the camera, you'll be able to tell how much green light there is. And that's an indicator of how green it is. And if you do this for long enough, you can come up with how the greenness of the planet has changed. And that's what this wonderful chart shows you. It's not trying to say, and people get confused here, not trying to say these places are all green, because clearly you can see part of this is a desert of Australia, where it's probably not very green. But what it's trying to say is it is greener than it was. So there is more greenery here. Even if it's only a tiny amount, there's more than there was 40 years ago. And almost everywhere you look on the planet has got greener. So perfectly, our hypothesis that being warmer and having more carbon dioxide makes things grow better is proved. And it's not only proved in a laboratory, it's proved in the entire world. And I think this is absolutely fantastic. When people talk about climate change destroying stuff, they never really think about the fact that the whole world here has got greener, has got more plants. And we can look on a little bit further. This here's a bit of a complicated graph, but one thing I like about this whole idea is that the carbon dioxide and the warmth is available to everybody in the world immediately. It's not just for rich people in the United States or Europe. It's for poor people in Africa and Asia and so forth. Their plants grow better too, not just our plants. And we can see here that the United Nations have been keeping track of how well the stuff we eat grows, cereal yields and cereal productions. And there's a lot of reasons behind this. Climate change and carbon dioxide is only one part of it, probably only a relatively small part of it. But over the last 60 years, you can see that the thing, the cereal yield, that's how much food you get from an area of land, and the production is how much actual total food you get, have both gone up. They've gone up vastly in 60 years, up over 200% in production and trebled 200% in yield. And it's gone up faster than the number of people in the world. And that says we've all got more to eat. When they tell you we're all starving because of climate change, well, no, we're not. It's not actually the case. We've got more food per person to eat. And so, yeah, but food is badly distributed and so forth. Well, maybe you got a point, but here's another chart we can find. And this is kilocalorie. If you've ever been on a diet, you'll know everything there is to know about calories. Sorry, bathroom scales, I'll start tomorrow. And this shows that everybody thinks about, you need about 2,500 calories per day to survive and thrive as a human being. And this shows that in every continent, we're about there. On every continent, everybody now has enough food to survive. That's probably the first time in human history we've ever been able to say that. And that's a fantastic achievement. So when they tell you climate change is starving the world, well, it ain't. And these two charts actually prove it. So tell them that, you know, they might be dreaming this stuff, but there is no data to prove it. Then say, but yeah, there was nearly a famine for 10,000 people in Madagascar. Well, maybe there was, but there's 8,000 million people in the world, and overall, we're all that much better off. What about dying from heat stroke? If you remember, my Greta Thunberg acolyte was convinced that she was going to die of heat stroke if she hadn't suffocated first. Well, it's not true either. If you go and look at what are the sources, the things that kill people about with temperature, it isn't being too hot. It's being too cold. And these guys at Monash University did a huge study. They looked at 5 million deaths, I think it was. And they looked at, you know, was it heat or cold that killed them? And it's by about overall, I think it's about 8 to 1, it's being too cold that kills people. But not only that, it's being too cold that kills people in every continent. You look at Africa, where you think, well, Africa's a hot place. Yeah, but it gets very cold at night. A lot of Africa's very high up, so there's thin air. It doesn't stay warm for long. In Asia, in Europe, in South America, in UK, in USA, in China, in India. Australia probably doesn't have many people dying at all, it seems. In all those places, it is being too cold that kills them. So when they say climate change is going to kill everybody by heat stroke, well, there's an awful lot of people it's going to save from dying of cold first before it gets up to too hot. So we need to bear that one in mind as well. What about life expectancy? We can look at life expectancy. And again, since the 1950s, life expectancy has gone up from about 47 to about 70. People are living longer lives during this period of climate change than shorter lives during the period of climate change. So if people tell you climate change is killing us all, well, it isn't. It's made up. The data tells you it isn't. And it's not what, well, Greta Thunberg says it is. Well, in which case, Greta Thunberg is wrong, or the IPCC, the big international body, is wrong. The data is unequivocal. We are living longer. The next one they come up with is rising sea level. Well, rising sea level is fantastic. We're all supposed to be dying of drowning of rising sea level. And our friends in NASA. Sorry, let me go back just one moment. To measure real sea level is hard. And the reason it's very hard to do so is it's like trying to find somewhere stable to stand to measure what the sea is doing. And land is not a stable thing. It's going up and down all the time. So it's difficult to find a reference point that doesn't move. In England, in Britain, for example, the southeast corner of the country is going down, and the northwest corner of the country up in Scotland is going up, and that's an isostatic rebound. So if you stand in London and try to measure, is the sea going up and down? You're always confused by the fact, well, the land is going down itself, and you'll do that wherever you are in the world. Now, NASA came up with a great idea that said, well, actually, if we were tried to measure it from a satellite, we know very precisely where a satellite is. We can come up with measurements, decent measurements of the sea level. And they tried to do that by radar. So you can think of it as a very sophisticated GPS system. And over the years, they've been doing it for 25 years now. And that you can see they've measured sea level, and they know roughly how fast it rises. And it's about 3.4 millimeters a year. Two parts to that, one of which is, like most things, when you heat up the seawater, it expands a tiny little bit. And the second part is, as you probably heard, well, there is, if you've got ice on land and it melts, eventually all that ice, that water ends up in the sea and the sea level rises. Yeah, so it does. No, one other thing though, If it's ice on the sea, so it's floating ice, it makes no difference. Floating ice melting makes no difference at all to sea level. So I can never quite understand why people get so excited about Arctic ice. Nasty, cold, barren stuff where nothing lives. Get rid of it. So anyway, so what does 3.4 millimeters a year work out as? Well, actually, in real money, that's a foot a century. 1 foot. And in case you've forgotten what 1 foot is, it's this thing. This is, I took this in my garden. Here's a foot rule, 30 centimeters. And here's four, and of course, of four, or three and a half ordinary British house bricks. And that's all it is. And when you look at it, that is the rate at which we're supposed to be being terrified of sea level. I would submit that if you really, really, really can't do enough to protect yourself from 1 foot of sea level every year, then you've really got some much bigger problems to worry about than that one.
1 foot per century, right?
1 foot per century, Tom. Yep. 1 foot per century. That's all it is. And it's just for fun, really. 20 years ago, the Maldives, the poster child for sea level rises, did a stunt. And here's the Prime Minister of the Maldives, the then Prime Minister of Maldives, signing papers underwater, trying to tell you that the Maldives are all going to disappear in 5 years or 10 years or whatever. First thing to notice is he didn't actually do it in the sea. He had to go and do it in a swimming pool so all the journalists could get there to take pictures and all that kind of stuff. No, the complete con. And second, over here on the right, this is the airport they're just expanding to get even more tourists to the Maldives because it's such a great tourist destination. But they opened four new airports during COVID just to be ready for the boom when it came. And now they're having to expand some of their other ones. So the Maldives haven't sunk, they aren't sinking. And indeed, their population is still rising. More people are going to live in the Maldives to service the tourists. You all want to come and watch it. So when you hear about the Maldives, it's a bit like you used to hear about the polar bears that were all going to die. You don't hear about the polar bears that were all going to die anymore. Why not? Because there's too many bloody polar bears. They're thriving. They're doing great. They love the warmer weather. Right, a bit more serious point here, because when we read about all the climate disasters, we see some numbers, and we've already seen from my friend who couldn't understand, didn't understand 42,000 and one in 1600. We need to understand just what the real numbers are for people who die anyway. Now, it's great to think, it's terrible to think 100 people died, yeah, but in global terms, is that a big number or a little number? So let's just try and get some numbers in your head. These are the ones I want you to take away. First question. There are 8,000 million people in the world. That's 8 billion people. So I'm using the British billion, 1,000 million. 8,000 million, 8 billion people in the world. Of which half of them, though just over half, are in Asia. Kind of forget that. We're very Western oriented, and we think, well, there's 300 million people in the United States and 500 million people in Europe, therefore. Well, no, we're not even a quarter of the size of the people in Asia. Of those 8,000 million people, 60 million die every year from any cause. You might say, well, that's the population is overall young, and that's why it's not more, you might expect it to be more than that, but it's 60 million people per year. If you do the arithmetic, that's 165,000 people a day die. You do it per hour, it's 7,000 an hour. And if you do it a minute, it's about 115 people a minute. Or if you want to think of it, it's two people every second die somewhere in the world. So if you keep those in mind when you look at deaths from terrible causes, you'll get that sense of perspective. So let's look. And there's a great database of people kept in one of the universities in Belgium. I think it's the University of Leuven, Liège. And this is climate disasters. And they've been keeping that records going back, getting on for 100 years, about how many people die of what you might call a climate disaster. And they specify here, floods, droughts, storms, wildfire, and extreme temperatures. So that's not just he died because he was warm, but, you know, real heat waves and stuff like that. And they keep the numbers. And you can see right now, down here in the 2020s, it's about 20,000 people a year die of a climate disaster. But you go back to the chart we just looked at, 7,000 people die every hour in the world. So you, if you want to do a little sum, you might say, well, that's about 3 hours worth of normal deaths per year. Maybe not quite so frightening as we thought it was. And then you look back up here, and this is 100 years ago, 1920, so it's my grandparents' time. You think, in those days, it was near 500,000, not 20,000. So this is where we can do some arithmetic, boys and girls. Here we go. What are your chances of dying in a climate disaster? Well, go back to 1920s. There were a lot fewer people. There's only about a quarter as many people in the world as there are today. So it's about 2 billion people. And about 500,000 of them died per year. And if you do the sum, that says, well, your chance then was 1 in 4,000 of dying of a climate disaster. And that's, yeah, I'm small, but 4,000, yeah, you can tell it's a good crowd at Aldershot on a Saturday, and one person dies of a climate disaster. Okay. That's a very good crowd at Aldershot, but we'll keep dreaming. Today, we've got four times as many people, 8 billion people. And only 20,000 deaths. And if you do the sum there, it's 1 in 400,000. So that's, for British people, that's Phil Wembley four times over, or nearly five times over. And you get one person dying. Very different thing. We are, from climate disasters, 100 times safer today than our grandparents were. And again, that's not the hype that you get from the press, where, you know, we're all expecting imminent Thermageddon to come around the corner. 3 weeks come next Tuesday. Bear that one in mind too. This is my favorite, wildfires. Wildfires are great because they're wonderful on television. You can have screaming people. You can have, you set up the camera and the fire does it all for you. Beautiful, red, colorful pictures and so forth. No work involved in journalism. In the UK, for example, we had last summer, there were big fires in a Greek island called Rhodes. And Rhodes is a very popular holiday island for Brits. So whatever happens in Rhodes, is, you know, many people have been there, so they're familiar with it. And there's big fires, and it was headline news, front top of the news every night for about a week, these terrible fires in Rhodes. And that got the whole nation worried and terrified of wildfires. And I did some work, and I went and tried to find how many people actually died of the wildfires, which, of course, were attributed to climate change. And as near as I can tell, the answer was zero. Nobody died in the big fires of Rhodes from climate change. Two very brave firefighters went in an aeroplane and flew their aeroplane into a tree. But that was the cause of their death, sadly. I'll pay tribute to them. The cause of their death was flying their aeroplane into a tree. It was not the wildfires. And when you look at it around the world, the sort of numbers of people who die of wildfires is about less than 200 every year. And if we go back to less than 200 every year, back to the chart, the yellow chart we looked at beforehand, that's about a minute's worth of people, maybe 2 minutes worth of people dying in a year. Now, I would suggest that if it's that much, 2 minutes worth out of a year, we really have got our priorities totally wrong if we're going to try and do big global things to save 2 minutes worth of people. Put this in perspective. This one says it's 140. And I think 10,000 people more, 10,000 times more people die on the roads every year. That's about 1.4 million people die on the roads every year. Let's look at floods. Now, floods do kill people. People drown and so forth and so on. But still, the number is in the thousands. And it's about 6,000 every year for the last 20 or 30 years. It's no more than that. And 6,000 is about an hour's worth of people dying from our yellow chart beforehand. So yes, floods are a problem, but they're not an existential threat to humanity. People do not die in big numbers of floods. One of the reasons is that for all these things, while the disasters are fewer and the fires are fewer, is we use technology. We've adapted to any changes. And technology allows people to have a lot greater time of warning and better facilities to get out of places that are at risk. You might actually say, well, many of the things that help there are actually driven by fossil fuels, which are the things that people don't like so much. But that's probably a debate for another day. Let's look at storms. Oh, big excitement. They're great too. Hurricanes are fantastic. They make terrific television. You just set up your camera, wait for the waves to come over, and you can have people, you know, fleeing Florida in endless lines of limousines or whatever it might be. Great stuff. But again, when you look at the actual number, it's down in the thousands, small number of thousands of people who die per year, which is, again, not the height that we're being told. You know, extreme weather, really. What they're really saying there is more hurricanes, and the hurricane's going to come and get you. If you're my age or 20 years younger in the UK, you might remember we had a hurricane one day. It was one hurricane in my lifetime, and it wasn't really a hurricane. It was a very strong wind. And there's lots of good jokes about the weather forecaster's incompetence in not noticing a hurricane's coming. When you look at, are there actually any more hurricanes? Hurricanes are big. You know, it's difficult to me, even if my friend Michael Fish in the UK Met Office missed one. Overall, it's very difficult for people to miss a bloody hurricane. So you can count them. You don't need sophisticated equipment. You know, they come in, you got 10 a year or 8 a year or 6 a year. You can't have 6.5 hurricanes or 14.73. You either have a hurricane or you don't. And you can count them. And this is the count for the last 40 years. And you can see that even if everybody's telling you there are more hurricanes, actually there aren't. But one point to note here, and this is nothing personal, Tom, but it's in a very American-centric idea. The people who count hurricanes in the North Atlantic coast of the United States. And they say that's hurricanes. Well, actually, worldwide, they have hurricanes, only they call them cyclones, in the Pacific as well, which the American guys never seem to notice. And it seems to be true that if the number of hurricanes in the Atlantic are going up, the number of hurricanes in the Pacific is going down. And that's why this says global hurricane frequency. It doesn't say North Atlantic hurricane frequency. So don't be fooled by looking at it just through that Americano-centric lens. Right. This is really my last formal chart. So we've looked over the last 45 minutes at some real data about climate and climate stuff. And this is what it tells us. First of all, we saw, as we might expect from basic chemistry, the world with more carbon dioxide and warmer is warmer, and it makes it greener. We've seen that helps to, it's by no means the only cause, but it helps to mean that people are living longer, have more food than ever before. We're in a position of better fed humanity than probably we've ever known. And the climate risks, which are the stick that everybody beats us up with every day, and you start to see even more of it. There's a climate conference starting in a week or so in Dubai, and already the hype is warming. When you look at the risks, they've been vastly exaggerated. These are not big risks taking away billions of people. They're small risks taking away tens of thousands at most. And nearly everywhere, whatever they are, the risks are falling. They're not going up, they're going down. So that's kind of the end of my formal presentation. I'll give you some homework. No good lecture is complete without some homework. And here's something to think about for the climate conference coming up. This is the idea of climate conferences is to get people to cut their emissions. The idea is if you cut your emissions of carbon, for whatever reason, this is good. And so you are a virtuous country if you cut your emissions of carbon. And you can look here. This is how carbon emissions have changed by continent over the last 30-odd years. You can see it's slightly gone down in North America, slightly gone down in Europe, slightly about the same in Africa, South America, and Oceania. And the one place where they haven't gone down is in Asia. And did I mention earlier, I think I did, that Asia has more than half the people in the world. Oh, I thought that's the answer to this first question. How many people live in Asia? It's 4 billion, just over. So here's the chart, the real data. And the question is, what does this chart tell us about the quest for global net zero emissions? Well, think about that. And you might make a hypothesis, like as Per Feynman, that, well, that's fantastic. All we have to do is persuade the people of Asia to give up these emissions. Well, we've been trying to do that for 40 years and failed. Or we might tell us that the quest for global net zero emissions is a complete waste of time and we might as well give it up right now. Or we might think somewhere in between. Anyway, think about that sort of stuff. Because when you know the real data, you can start to think about these things and come up with some real sensible thoughts. When all you get is the hype in the papers, you're just being led by the nose by the hype. Thank you for your kind attention. Here's the guys who helped me do this. I just mentioned Tilak Doshi, who I think has already been one of your contributors, Tom. John from Chasing Dissent, who's a podcaster, know very well in the UK. Thanks, John. I told you I was going to do this. This is what we ended up with. And my friend Graham, who's my drama coach, who's a lifelong friend, who's a drama teacher. And of course, all my friends and foes on Twitter. Thanks again.
First, I'd just like to say that was a great presentation. I really enjoyed that you laid it out and put things in perspective so clearly. So thank you for taking the time to do that.
Great. Glad you. That was what I was hoping to do. So mission accomplished.
My major question is, I really enjoy your Twitter feed. And I'm just wondering, do you have advice for the rest of us as to how to succeed on Twitter?
Well, that's it. That's an excellent question. I think mine work because one, I've got in mind somebody I'm trying to influence. So let me tell you what that person looks like and you'll understand it. The person I'm trying to get through to is a lady. She's coming home from work on the London Underground. She's got her smartphone and she's flicking through. She's probably worried about what the kids are going to have for tea tonight. And you're trying to grab her attention in that 1 second of attention time. She's probably strap hanging. She'd get busy moving around. You haven't got a lot of time. You can't be subtle and sophisticated and here two fours and notwithstanding. It's got to be direct. It's got to be straightforward. It's got to be understandable. So pictures make a great deal of difference, particularly if you can find a good picture that makes the point. Cartoons are fantastic. I don't know if you know a guy called Josh the Cartoonist in the UK. I had coffee with him in the Houses of Commons not very long ago, very nice too. And he's great at just summing up big, complicated things in one picture. I don't know if you can imagine trying to do that. But use simple words, not big, long, complicated ones. Be direct. Sarcasm and all that stuff, I used to try that, and it never works on Twitter because people misunderstand it. Tell them what... The old army guys, you would ask a regimental sergeant major, what is it? How are you going to teach this troop to fire a rifle or regimental sergeant? He says, well, sir, he says, it's very simple. He says, first I tells them what I'm going to tell them. Then I tells them what I told them. And then they all understand. It's kind of simple like that. Straightforward, direct, visual, and quick. And if you can get all those, people understand, people get it. If you can put in a dose of humor as well, and sometimes my jokes fall flat, occasionally they work. If you can put in a little bit of that, that helps too. That creates an atmosphere that people are willing to do more with you. Yeah, try those, but it takes a bit of practice. It takes, 100,000 tweets before you get it right. Oh, and by the way, look at the little things at the bottom of a tweet tell you how many people have looked at it and how many likes you've got and how many retweets you've got. That's a great, academic people would call it, it's peer review. It tells you how many people looked at it and how many people liked it. And it's an immediate way of getting feedback on whether it works or not. That's the great thing about Twitter is it is immediate. Yeah.
And a follow-up question is, do you have advice for us in getting your points across in real life, if you're just talking to somebody on a bus or whatever? Any comments there?
Same thing. You don't need to be different. Well, all right, two things. One, never be rude to anybody. If you're rude to anybody, I get people on Twitter who say, "Listen, you cretinous moron." I'm thinking, well, if you really think this is going to influence me more to your point of view by anything like that, buddy, you got another thing coming, because I switch off and people go into fight or flight mode when that happens, and it doesn't work. So be polite, be direct, know your stuff, listen to them, and then if they're wrong, put them right. But do it in a way they don't feel threatened by. Now that is hard when you come to the religious aspect of it, because a lot of climate cult is a religion. It's not fact-based. I want to believe this because I need to believe that I'm important in some save the world type, or whatever it might be. There's strong religious element. You can look at that just in the iconography you have, pictures of Greta and all those things. We sent a 17-year-old virgin to go and speak at the United Nations, and she was received with rapturous applause. Hang on a minute. Have I heard this story somewhere before? It's Christmas coming up. Whether you believe in Christianity or not. But it's the same stuff all over again. It's just it's a different myth. Same ideas being recycled and being lapped up by the same people. They are probably beyond help. And the last thing I'd say on that is that people don't have conversions on the road to Damascus. You can't come up to somebody and say, "Here you are, sir. Look, here's fact number one," boring and put in front of them. And they suddenly say, "Oh, Latimer, you're right. I've been wrong all my life. Thank you for opening my eyes." The reason they put that down in the Bible, when St. Paul or wherever it was on the road to Damascus had this conversion, was it was so unusual. Yeah. What you can do, however, is you can influence people over a period of time and give them the sort of intellectual space and time to modify their views a bit. They're like a super tank. The super tanker's coming towards you like this, and then they say, there's a Tom Nelson in the way. I better do something. And, 10 miles away, they start veering off to the right a bit. And eventually, by the time you get to Tom Nelson, maybe they're actually heading in the opposite direction. But it's a gentle process. And then when they eventually come around and totally agree with you, they say, "Well, I always did anyway." But it doesn't matter if they've done that. The point is they've got there. And if they want to fool themselves that they did it anyway, don't care. It doesn't matter. Being right, actually, being intellectually right doesn't really matter. If you've got the people's influence and you have them, understanding it in the end, how they got there is not of great significance.
Was there ever any time when you bought into the climate scam, or were you suspicious from the very beginning?
Well, the reason I got into it was when I left big computing, and before I started on the buses, I had half a day to spare. And I'd not looked at climate for years, but my master's stuff had been a lot of atmospheric type chemistry. We were doing the opposite of photosynthesis. Photosynthesis making things we like. We were destroying things we like. We were bashing light through stuff, making it fall apart and seeing what happened after that and how it came back together again. But I had half a day and they'd all been telling me climate science is settled. So I genuinely thought if I sat down with half a day on the internet, I'd see what fantastic science these guys had done in the 35 years or whatever it was since I'd last done any proper science. So I was looking for when climate science is settled, and it isn't. It wasn't then, and it never has been. And the more I looked at it, and the more I came to doing just the simple stuff I've shown you today, checking the numbers, the more I came to the conclusion that it was not really a science. It's a sort of, let's try and pretend some models and keep the cult going over. And it doesn't meet Feynman's test of, if it disagrees with the experiment, it's wrong, because there's no way that a lot of this stuff gets tested. You've got a climate model that says, well, in 50 years, the crop of wheat in Bangladesh will be 30% less than it is tomorrow. Therefore, you must do something. I have no way of testing this model. It might even be right, but it's more likely to be wrong. But there's no way you can test it. It's impossible to test. So you might as well say, well, right, tell me what the football results are next week. You can only test that when you've done the football result. I know some professional climate scientists, and to be honest, they mean well and they think they're doing it right, but they stick themselves in this bubble of climate science. One of my climate skeptic buddies is a professor at a very prestigious university in sort of somewhere on the boundary between chemistry and physics, and he calls climate science a pathological science, and I think he's got a good point. It's not. It relies too much on the human bit. You know, the human consensus. They look, 97% of us agree. Well, big deal. 100% of homeopaths think it works as well. The fact that you all agree with it doesn't tell you anything. It's a statement about yourselves. It's not a statement about climate science, about science.
Excellent stuff. Any final points you'd like to make before we wrap this one up?
No, just thank you very much for inviting me. I'm flattered to be included in your such a distinguished list of previous guests, and I hope people have enjoyed it. You can find me on Twitter as @LatimerAlder, and of course, always happy to hear what people have to say. If you're reasonably polite, you might even get an answer as well.
All right. Thank you for all your great work. I'll talk to you next time. Latimer Alder.
Cheers.
Goodbye.